Intervju Radija Študent.
Pozdravljeni v terminu RŠ Intervju. Danes poslušamo pogovor z Kitom Rowom, legendarnim improvizatorjem, pionirjem preparirane kitare in enim najbolj pronicljivih akterjev na eksperimentalni sodobni glasbeni sceni. Pred par urami smo opravili pogovor, ki ga bomo kratkar poslušali. Kit Row včeraj nastopil v galeriji Mota Point, pred njim je imel solistični nastop še Samo Kutin. Rekla smo nekaj o njegovem setu včeraj, kjer je izvedel dve kompoziciji, nocoj pa nastopi v Menzi pri koritu, skupaj še s saksofonistom Martinom Kuhnom in plesalcem Rizotom Fukuharo. Izvajali bojo kompozicijo Martina Kuhna Killing the Houses, Killing the Trees. Prosti so me, naj povem, da se koncert začne točno ob 9 oziroma hmalo po 9, ker bo enkrat, ko se bo stvar začela, bojo vrata zaprta, zaradi specifične narave dogodka ne bojo možne več motnje, tako da vabljeni na to zvečer v Menzu pri koritu, sedaj pa prisluhnemo intervju. Okay, so Kit, yesterday you did a great solo set where you played two compositions, in fact, and the first one was by Christian Wolf, who you told me was in 68 for a year part of AMM. You invited him, and could you maybe talk a little bit of this composition? It was called Edges.
Yes, Christian Wolf had a sabbatical from his university post in America, and he knew Cornelius Cardew. Mm. Cornelius Cardew was in AMM at the time, and Cornelius knew John Cage Feldman in New York School, and Christian came to London for a year's sabbatical, and we invited him to become part of AMM for that year. And one of the things he did during that year was to, 1968, he wrote Edges. Mm. Edges, I always smile actually when I think of Edges, because it's very odd. It's the score itself is kind of written instructions and lines and squiggles and very, very spaced out on the page. And in the instruction for how to approach the piece, Christian writes something very strange. He says, what the performer primarily plays is not what is on the score. So I think, how can you have something on the score and say not play it? So this is why it's called Edges, that you approach the edge of something's zone, but you don't go into it, you know. It's almost contradictory, I think. It's almost like Ben Patterson has an instruction in one of his pieces which says, do not think of number 7. You say to Ben, that's impossible. You've got to think of number 7 not to think about it. So how can you not? Yeah. So it had the same kind of quality of, you have the score, but you don't play what's on the score. So it's almost, if you have the perfume from an activity, the smell or the scent from it, and that's what you perform. And Christian says, if it was a dance piece, if you were doing Edges as a dance piece, you would know the dance from the absence of the movements. So you would work out what movements were never made, and that would be what the piece is, you know. So it's a fantastic piece, and I love it because it's so open that you cannot bang on the table and say it has to be done this way and it has to be done that way. And as you probably noticed, I had my own kind of menu of sounds that I do for each of the piece, yeah. You know. Yeah. And I think it's to perform it with a lot of care, thinking of Christian. Thinking of Christian's other compositions, like Stones or Sticks, where you have the instruction that you mustn't break anything. So I think that, you know, I would carry that over into Edges. And I think the other instruction from Burdock's, another Wolf composition, is think fast, play slow. And I think that also affects the way that I did Edges last night. Mm-hmm. So I would, in a sense, playing Edges, but also being influenced by other Christian Wolff compositions, which I suppose is normal. I guess if you're playing Haydn, you might get influenced by other Haydn pieces and actually allow them to influence what you do. So, yeah.
But now you've been playing this piece for a few decades.
Yeah.
And is there maybe a thought you had that how much different was it when you first played it and after all these decades of your research and activity? Mm. Maybe the way you approach it, or because you also said it was a kind of tribute to him.
Yeah.
Connected with his birthday.
Yeah, this year, Christian, 2014, Christian will be 80 years of age. And I wanted to salute that and to recognize it and to pay tribute, you know, to him. It must have changed over the years. It must have changed. But I would have to say, normally it's done in as a group activity. Normally there are five or six. In fact, prior to this, I'd done it with an ensemble with Christian Wolff. And I made a horrible error. Yeah. I mean, he's very generous, but he did give me a rather stern look. I think one of the things about Christian, you'll notice last night it was quite short.
Yeah.
And the mistake I made once in an ensemble in Boston at the music school in Boston, we should have played it for maybe eight minutes, and I played it for like 9 minutes. Mm-hmm. I played a minute more than I should have done. That was a mistake. I shouldn't have done that. So keeping it quite short, keeping it quite economic. See, if something's got edges, what should its duration be? How can you think about the duration of something called edges? Should it be a long piece? Well, no, it shouldn't. It shouldn't go. It shouldn't develop. It shouldn't indulge. So maybe, I mean, we often say that the greatest strength that music has is its transience, its uncatchability, that you can't catch it, you can't hold it in your hand. Maybe a short performance of uncatchability, right, will typify its uncatchability, because you don't have enough time.
But in a way, this is a good description of what you've been doing.
Yeah.
With your approach.
Yeah.
To also to solo playing.
Yeah.
So maybe, were these kind of pieces like Christian Wolff's Edges or Treatise a kind of companion to your improvising career?
Oh, yeah,
in
yeah.
a way, I mean, yeah. they probably something. It's something you lived with.
Yeah, they're part of my life. I can imagine that if I can only imagine this, but I imagine if I was a classical cello player, in my cello case, I would have the six Bach suites, you know, and I would get up in the morning, I'd have my coffee and my croissant or whatever I have. Like at 9 o'clock, I would open the cello case, tune up and play some Bach for 30, 40 minutes, just to locate the day, to find out, to exist. And for me, I've normally have Treatise somewhere in my...
Also when you play solo, right?
Yeah. And sometimes I even will play a page of Treatise from memory. You know, like page 54 or something, which starts, so that would be like it starts from number two, actually. A lower scrape, a middle scrape, a shorter, higher scrape, another two, a line that goes zigzag, and then a one, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, in a way, Treatise is like your Bach.
Yeah, exactly.
For your setup.
Yeah, exactly, for me. Yeah.
Also, that's interesting because the second composition you did was by Frank Abbinanti. I guess he's a younger composer.
No, he's not so young. No, he's older gentleman.
Okay. Yeah. But it was called City Music for Electric Guitar, and it featured another element which is prominent in your work, which is the radio.
Yeah.
And so I wanted to ask you, how does the use of the radio in this composition relate to what you do either way with the radio when you improvise? There's a strong connection, I think.
Yes, yeah. No, you're right. It's It was written for me in 1988, so 20 years after Edges. Mm-hmm. And it was just called City Music. And basically, City Music was about the known and the unknown. It was about cities that you knew and cities that you did not know. And the score is both a verbal score, verbal instructions, which are much more like philosophical about cities and existence and location. There are city maps, which are both a regular map of Paris, but then reversed. It's as if you're seeing it backwards.
Okay.
Yeah. So that's obviously a city that you don't know. Then there are maps of cities that I've never visited, like Delhi, Peking, you know, Beijing, blah, blah, blah. And then maps of cities I do know, like London, New York, whatever. And the use of the... It doesn't stipulate that you use the radio, but it's a natural part of my kind of palette, if you like. Yeah. So I discussed it over the years with Frank, how I might approach it with a specific radio version, which means that the radio would really feature really, really strongly. I think sometimes when it was just city music without the electric guitar bit, I tended to just as little snippets from radio, and it was mostly about the electric guitar. So then he changed it to city music for electric guitar, because the electric guitar bit was much more prominent. But as the radio became more and more, I think I just had the feeling that the location of the radio and the contrasting of knowns and unknowns and the contradictions of if I at home record some Indian radio from shortwave and I record it, I put it on my loop station and I play it in the performance, it's contradictory because it's an unknown city, but I know the radio grab, I know how that feels. So it's not completely unknown, I know it and I don't know it. So it's this kind of twilight zone between known and unknown.
But you also use random radio?
Oh yeah,
yesterday.
Right, that's right, that's right. So it's a combination of radio stations I've recorded from cities I don't know and contrasting with live radio from cities I do know, the one I'm in. Mm-hmm. So from last night, they were like local FM, so it must be within 26 or so kilometres.
Yeah.
So I'm contrasting those two. Then you have the added thing of that sometimes, well, like last night, there were things being spoken which I don't understand because I don't speak the language. So there's, I know where it's from, but I don't know what it's saying. Okay, I know it's from the radio.
Now that you're explaining the way you do it, could Abinanti, the composer, could he have predicted that you will approach this piece in this way? Because it's really specific the way you juxtapose. What does it mean to have an unknown known loop? Out there.
Yeah. So. And it's obviously, which you probably will have recognized, that in a way it's a piece of pop art too. Mm. It's very close to Andy Warhol or kind of British or American pop art. You know, that very, very strong radio songs, you know. Mm. Like the songs from last night, like Kylie Minogue, and I mean, I don't know them all.
Yeah.
Now, some of them you indulge in, some of them you allow them to run, as if you love them, as if you like them, and other ones you eliminate with the electric guitar. So the electric guitar becomes the observer. The idea of the observer comes from watching another known and unknown, which is Samuel Beckett's film with Buster Keaton, where you have the observer and you don't see Buster Keaton's face in the film, you only see it from the back of the head. So you know who it is, but the normal knowing of someone would be their face. So it's tracking someone from behind. So, yeah, like last night's performance, for me, it was a a liquid version of a pop painting. It was actually a painting, but that was delivered in a kind of liquid form, in a form that you couldn't hold.
It's a transient form.
Yeah.
More connected with sound.
Yeah.
This also goes way back to your starting position, which you always emphasized, the fact that you're a painter, in fact, and that you started from painting, the way that you approach. And I also wanted to ask you, how has this... I mean, obviously, you've been doing it for a lot of time, and I remember once reading that you said that you have a feeling that not a lot of people, and especially writers, don't really understand the processes you've been going through through all these years. So maybe you could speak a bit on this, or maybe how do you feel nowadays, or how has it changed? Or well, because I sometimes get the feeling that the things that you do are getting more and more rigorous and more and more extreme, and maybe...
Well, I could take me about 5 hours to answer that very simple observation of yours. The thing I don't want to do is allow it to settle. I don't want to allow what I do to find an easy... goes really way back to my very early days at art school. The thing I wanted to avoid in my life would be to enter something then, when I was 18 or 19, I called the zone of indifference. I did not want to enter the zone where it was indifferent, meaning that it had gone to sleep, that it would just operate from its cliches, from its safe zone. You know, I always wanted to not have safety first, but have safety last, that the whole thing should be unsafe, that it should never feel polished, never feel as if it should always feel as if it's been abandoned, as if I've walked away from it, and to disguise, as you rightly say, I actually rigorously work through everything. I mean, it's unbelievable the amount of work I do on every possible detail. Every detail is really worked on. But I never want it to appear like that. I always want it to appear as if it's scrappy and out of the box. Yeah, but I work really hard at that, you know. And at the moment, for example, sometimes the layout on the table in front of me gets very complex. And then I'll just shift gear and want to simplify it. And I'm just at the moment working out a way. I've got a metal case, a travel case, a very small one. And I'm going to see if I can, in my next kind of maybe next 6 months, try to work from this ultra simplified stuff, which simplifies maybe a criticism I have about contemporary life. So I think a lot of us know less and less about more and more. And I would like to reverse that and actually have know more and more about less and less. So have less layers. So I normally work on, say, 10 layers of sound. It's layered in about 10 layers. I reduce that, say, to 5. Last night, both performances were kind of relatively short. Which didn't give me a chance to juxtapose the types of silences. Normally what I would like to do is work on, in edges even, or in city music, to actually contrast different types of silence, you know, to have a John Cage-type silence after a particular scrape or a rub, say a rub with a John Cage silence. Then a scrape. John Cage silence is much more laid back, much more open to something we refer to as nature. Then a much more violent scrape, a particular kind of a scrape which will give you a David Tudor silence, which is very different from a John Cage one. And then contrast all of that to, say, a Wagnerian silence, you know. And try. Some of them I can't always reliably manage. I think Elgar, the kind of silence you would find in the cello concerto by Elgar. There's a silence in there which I struggle to be able to kind of look. I know what I can emotionally get it, but instrumentally I can't quite go there. But so maybe with a stripped down setup, maybe I'll be able to concentrate more on, without making it a fetishistic fetishism, you know.
Yeah. But speaking of silence, now I think it's interesting because the very first thing you did with the Edges composition, the first silence that followed, the first script, it was like all the things you were talking about silence, but compressed.
Yeah.
Because it was not so long. But I had a distinct impression with your first gesture that, this is a kind of Kitrov silence. It had all the, the gravity, the harshness, and it was not musical, it was nothing, it was not conceding anything. Yeah. So I thought you were doing a lot of things that might get need a bit more time usually you play, but yesterday it was compressed.
Yeah.
I don't know, maybe it was a compositional format.
Yeah. Well, I think when we play music, sometimes we think about the production of sound. And we work quite hard on making sound, making the phrase, getting the phrase right, getting... You know, I often think that when you make a sound, any sound, you needed to have thought of hundreds of things. You needed in your life to have considered lots and lots of things, you know. But what we don't do is actually spend the equivalent amount of time working on silence. You know, producing silence. So when you make a sound, you also have to, I feel anyway, you have to be responsible for the silence. The silence isn't something that just happens, that you have no responsibility for. You have to shape the silence in the way that you shape the sound. So therefore that first silence yesterday, it's a particular type of silence.
Which I think it's not so easy to produce, because I know I would like to hear more of it, but it's a lot of silences I don't like.
They're
not extreme enough.
Yesterday
it was. I think I would even say that you could hear a lifetime's work in that little fragment, a scrape and a silence.
Yeah.
This maybe relates to another thing I wanted to ask you, because you often said that. The way you approach the guitar and the materials you use, anyway, is of course a step away from conventional expressive practices. But also, the one thing I thought was important that you were always saying that it's should be more something that reflects about the kind of world that you live in. And you've been approaching it this way for a long time. And maybe is it most of these things that you find out working like this? Mm. Is most of it invisible? Does anyone know how this progresses in your work? I mean, in a way, you go around with a bunch of trash, a bunch of ephemeral things, which is what life amounts to, a way.
Yeah.
And something about this. How do you view it?
I would. That discussion about. How our experience of life enters into how we play our music. It's a discussion I will have with John Tilbury, for example, a piano player. And I think in a way, when I play with John, which I will do in a week or so's time, it's a very rounded experience, because I think what I do is I, in a way, show the world how it is. And John illustrates maybe how we would like the world to be. And it makes a very complete statement. And when I try to illustrate how the world I would like the world to be, I always seem to end up by reflecting how the world is. So last night the radio grabs in City Music, you could say they're a mirror. They're holding a mirror up, not It's not like I'm holding a mirror to the audience, but a mirror is being held up to the audience. Mm-hmm. This is reflecting back. This is now. This is our culture now. This is the reality coming back from the radio. And I think it's something that we worried about in the late 60s in England as music makers. It was called it was called Music for Whom? Mm-hmm. Who is music for? You know, and we always felt that music should be not for the elite, but for the ordinary people. But then our contradiction is the music that we make isn't for ordinary people. Mm-hmm. Ordinary people like Kylie Minogue and, you know, Madonna and all that stuff, you know, and not what we do. In fact, they hate what we do. Yet here we are, politically, wanting to make music. Which so I would say, for the most part, if we're going to look at failure in life, if you were to ask me where we failed, or where I failed, I speak for myself, I would say that's probably one area which I've not, I failed. Working out this thing of music for whom. But then I think of painting. We think of like Picasso, Pablo Picasso. I think of the great work, the Demoiselle d'Avignon, with those very so-called savage kind of faces. That must have been viewed as a complete... all the Matisse, the dancers from Matisse, is probably viewed now as one of the most beautiful paintings that ever was made. But at the time, was probably one of the most ugly paintings that was made at the time. Mm. So whether there's a possibility that the music that we make at the moment, which would horrify most audiences and most ordinary people wouldn't like it, one day will be seen as beautiful, I don't know.
But do you think this is agreeable to have this kind of outcome?
Oh, I really don't know. I really don't know. Yeah. I honestly don't know. You could ask me 1 minute and I think, yeah, well, maybe. Then I think, no, probably not. Oh, yeah, maybe. No, I can't settle.
Okay, great. So now maybe just some question about what you were going to play today. Today you're doing another composition with Martin Kuchen.
Yeah.
And dancer Yuzo Fukuhara. Maybe... just if you can shortly explain how it came about.
Well, I don't know how it came about. All I know is that Martin emailed an invitation to take part in it. And when he sent the score, I kind of realised why he invited me to do it and maybe not anyone else, in a way. And it goes back to what we've just been talking about, is the use of material, not radio grabs, but recordings brought into a performance and brought into a performance in no uncertain terms, not disguised, they're in-your-face kind of items. Yeah. Vivaldi, piece by Vivaldi from an opera. I'm still quizzing Martin. We're slowly kind of getting there to why the pieces are there, what it is, why he wants these pieces to be there. I really don't have a very complete answer. So the Caballeres piece, there's an oud piece, and there's a Vivaldi opera piece, and specific minutes. We have a timeline, and there are activities on the timeline that you're doing. And you know, at 6 minutes 25 seconds, I bring in the Caballeres piece, and I play it for X number of minutes. What we're talking about, they seem at the moment too crudely set. We're trying to work out ways. You know, an object. How we know an object. we better know an object when it's been used, when it's got itself dirty, mm-hmm. you know. When it's shiny and new, it doesn't tell us very much. It's when it's been used and worn, we know more about it. Mm. And I think that's the problem we're having with these pieces of music.
But it's not the only thing you do in this composition?
Almost.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
But you played the thing before.
We did, yeah. But I think on this occasion I'm going to have to play more because there are less musicians.
Ah, okay.
Yeah. So when we have a rehearsal in half an hour okay. time, I will know what I'm supposed to be doing.
Okay.
But up till now, the only thing I've really done is this, is introducing the radio, not the radio, introducing these grabs, these, I suppose, things from the iPod, you know.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so good luck with tonight. Thank you for the interview.
No, thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
To je bil pogovor s Kitom Rowom, ki nastopi tudi nocoj, Menzi pri koritu, skupaj z Martinom Kuhinom na saksofonu in pesalcem Jiruzetom Fukuharo. Stvar se začne v 9, bodite točni, ker kasneje vstop ne bo več možen in slišimo. Čau.
Intervju Radija Študent.